You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, March 15th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a special guest rogue with us this evening, all the way from Australia, Richard Saunders.
Hello, rogues. Hello. I hardly know what country I'm in. I've just flown back from the United Kingdom, in fact, only 2 days ago. So I'm still not sure about time zones and all that.
Yeah, you are definitely an international jet setter.
An international skeptic of mystery.
People still use that phrase? Jet setter.
As long as you guys use that phrase, that's okay.
It's coming back.
So what were you doing? Where were you? In the UK, you said?
I was. I had a wonderful time as a guest of the people at QED, Question, Explore, Discover, the convention in Manchester that was a couple of weeks ago. And what a great convention it was. It was sort of like being in a bizarro world of being at a TAM, but being in the UK, which wasn't a TAM. It was that good. It was just fantastic.
Cool.
Yeah, I went last year. Those guys did a great job.
I've been dying to go. I've got to find the time to get out there. But it's always for you know how it is, Richard. You mean it's much harder for you. You got to take a lot of time off. You can't just pop over. It's you got to take days off to get there.
I love travel, but I'd travel twice as far as I have to go to something like QED in Manchester. They put on such a great convention. Good to catch up with some old friends like DJ Grothy and Joe Nickel, of course.
Well, let's get started. We actually have a lot of news items to get through. Evan, you're going to start us off with This Day in Skepticism, covering for Rebecca, which I should mention, if you haven't figured it out by now, Rebecca is off this week. So, Evan, you're back in your old role.
Ooh. Let me get comfy. Yeah. Oh, still fits. This is good. I'm comfortable. All right. March 17, 1958, the Vanguard 1 satellite was successfully launched into Earth orbit. So what was special about this particular satellite? It was the fourth artificial satellite launched into space, but the first to be solar powered.
Really?
It is still up there. It is
still working?
Not still working. They kind of lost, functional communication with it back in 1964.
So it's a hunk of metal.
Yeah.
Orbiting the Earth now.
It wasn't always that. It evolved into just a hunk of metal.
It's space junk.
It's still, operated longer than they thought. First solar panel, Steve. Come on.
Yeah, that's good. That's great.
They'd say it's going to remain in orbit well into the 22nd century. This thing was built to last, basically, except for the,
Not necessarily to function, but to last.
Right, right. And part of the larger Vanguard project, which served lots of different functions, its primary function was to obtain accurate measurements of the Earth through orbit analysis. And they determined, its precise shape, sort of for the first time we really knew that it had these bulges.
Lopsided oblate spheroid.
Exactly. So we learned some good stuff. And if you look at a picture of it, it reminds you of certainly Sputnik, that sort of, image with this, the ball and kind of the thin arms protruding from it. So it has that sort of retro satellite look and feel to it.
A retro satellite look. Isn't that a funny expression?
Who would have ever thought we'd be able to say that?
Yeah,
so, we're at a point where satellites can look retro.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Kind of like a retro laser pistol.
Right?
Well, laser pistols have always been retro.
Right. And they don't even really exist.
When they finally invent them, do you think they'll make them look like phasers or they're old things on the TV?
I hope so.
Yeah, if you figure that if the aesthetic actually doesn't really matter that much, if they have to put a cool casing on it or whatever, they better damn well make it look like a phaser from Star Trek or something from Star Wars. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but a cool one, not a lame one.
Lost in Space rifles.
Oh, those were bad.
All right, well, thanks, Evan.
Sure.
The first news item, this is a quickie, but this is really neat. Scientists discovered, it's not that kind of quickie, not that quickie.
Oh, okay.
But scientists have discovered the oldest skeleton on the Earth. You guys hear this?
Yeah, this is pretty cool. Yeah. It's like a chordate, worm-like.
Yeah, it's not a skeleton of a human, obviously. It's the oldest skeleton of any kind of creature. The species is Corona collina, Acula, A-C-U-L-A. This is actually a pre-Cambrian animal from the Ediacaran era. So they date it from between 560 to 550 million years ago. The Cambrian explosion occurred around 542 million years ago. This is this creature lived on the ocean floor, like attached to the floor. Looks like a little thimble with at least four long spicules coming out from it, which they don't know what the purpose of those structures were. They could have been just to sort of stabilize it on the ocean floor. And Richard, you know where this fossil was found?
I certainly do. It was in my backyard. It was just extraordinary. No, it was found in South Australia.
Yeah.
And you know what? It really does look sort of like Sputnik.
It does.
It does.
Yeah.
Like a thimble Sputnik instead of a grapefruit Sputnik. But yeah, the four spicules kind of look like the antenna.
It does. It's very strange. But there are certainly a wealth of very, very old fossils in Australia.
Yeah.
But this one is a bit of a surprise. This one is really old.
Yeah, this is cool for a lot of reasons. For some quick background, you know, the Cambrian explosion is when we first start to see multicellular animals in the fossil record with hard parts. Now, there are some fossils of Ediacaran fauna from before the Cambrian, but they're mainly soft-bodied, like flat type of creatures. And one question is, well, what happened to the Ediacaran fauna, and where did the Cambrian fauna come from? One hypothesis was that, well, the Ediacaran fauna essentially died out, you know, right before the Cambrian explosion. But the other possibility is that animals and plants or whatever, creatures that are present in the Cambrian explosion, were around. They existed in the Precambrian. They just hadn't developed hard parts yet that fossilized, so we don't see them. So that the Cambrian explosion, in part, is an artifact of the fossil record. It may actually represent a dramatic, rapid increase in the number of animals, you know, in the world. But it's also partly just that when animals start to develop hard parts, they will suddenly appear in the fossil record, even if they had a much longer history. Well, this creature actually has some structures in common to Cambrian sponges. And that suggests that this creature is an ancestor to certain animals that exist in the Cambrian. And therefore, not all of the Ediacaran fauna went extinct. And Cambrian creatures, their ancestors were around in the Precambrian. So that sort of supports there was a long lead up to the Cambrian explosion, and it really was partly or mostly an artifact of developing hard parts that the quote-unquote explosion occurred. So this is actually a really important fossil find in terms of our understanding of, you know, this period of time on the Earth and the evolution of life. And it actually is also, in a way, an important evolutionary prediction, you know, that there would have been antecedents to the Cambrian fauna. You know, these creatures would not have come out of nowhere. They had to have ancestors, and now we found one. Just, it also makes sense that we would find the first creature to develop hard parts. Maybe there are others out there, you know, that are waiting to be discovered. And you're right, Richard, Australia is a rich location for this period of time. The oldest things,
yes,
living things that we're finding on the Earth are being discovered in Australia.
Yes, and I'm one of them, I think.
Yeah.
Not quite there yet.
But it's an interesting, the way you put this is the explosion, where it may have been, of course, an explosion before, but we don't know about it. But I guess you could still classify it if these skeletons came along. Well, then it's an explosion of this form of life, the ones that adapted skeleton, something which could fossilize. So I guess it's an explosion no matter how you look at it.
Yeah, you know, of course, the creationists try to present it as like a sudden creation, but that's not what we're talking about at all.
No.
You know, and sudden meaning over millions of years.
Yes, we gotta be careful with the way we express ourselves here. If we say an explosion or sudden, it's like in slow motion, of course. But it's just the I guess it's just the way that we're used to using the word when we speak about the fossil record.
Yeah, it's geologically sudden, but it's still a long period of time. Let's move on. Jay, we have another sort of archaeology or paleontology-related item. Paleontologists have other skeleton news have discovered perhaps a new species of human living not that long ago.
In other skeleton news, I like that. A team of scientists have been studying bones of five or maybe more individuals that date between 11,500 and 14,500 years ago. And this collection of bones has been named after one of the sites the bones were found. And that's why they are called, what are these people called?
Red Deer Cave people.
Right, because one of the sites was called the Red Deer Cave. But it wasn't the sole site. There were actually several sites that they were finding the bones. So the bulk of the skeletal remains have been in a Chinese collection or one or more Chinese collections, but recently the collection has been under extensive investigation. And they're finding a lot of really, really interesting things about this. The skulls and teeth from two locations are very similar, and this most likely means that they're from the same population. And they also found that they're having a mix of archaic and modern characteristics. The features are considered distinct from modern humans. And some of the descriptors that they gave were thick skull bones, short and flat faces, broad noses, rounded brain cases, prominent brow ridges, and the jaws also jut forward, but lack a modern human-like chin. They had modern-looking frontal lobes, but quite archaic-looking anterior or parietal lobes. Steve, what does that actually mean?
There's one of the lobes of the brain. You have the frontal lobes, which are in the front, the temporal, which is like by your temple. The parietal lobe would be behind that, and then the occipital lobe in the very back.
Cool. So those parts of their brains weren't as developed as a modern human.
Well, they're just going by the shape of the skull, right, to infer what the development of the various parts of the brain.
Sure, but that's a pretty good indication.
Yeah, but one thing that struck me about this is when I was reading about it was it said that the skeletons and the skulls were like a mishmash of archaic and modern features. And the first thing I thought was like, oh boy, Piltdown Man, how do they know that this isn't a hoax, and what steps have they taken to really verify that this is a legitimate thing? And I was just wondering if it struck you guys the same way as it struck me when I read about it. And it's weird because even the fact that it was found in China made me think, are they just trying to get some notoriety and are they making this stuff up?
I'll tell you why I think that it seems more legitimate. First of all, they're not making any claims of anything definite. They're saying a lot of maybes and I'm going to talk in a little bit later because I have a lot more information to give you guys that, they have a few ideas about the origin and all that, but they're very openly saying that they need to do a lot more investigation. They're actually trying to do DNA testing to get some more information about them. And plus, Bob, this isn't just some random skull.
There are five individuals, Bob, and for me, that's the biggest hedge against this being a hoax. I agree. Listen, okay. China has a history of fossil fraud, of selling, fake fossils to make money.
Right.
So you always got to be curious. And but it looks like they're coming under scrutiny. We obviously have to wait for to really be evaluated by the scientific community. But it sounds like they're starting to be evaluated. And again, I think the fact that there are multiple individuals, I think that this also fits quite well with what we've been discovering over the last 10 years or so, that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, and other subspecies were
getting it on.
Right? there were lots of subpopulations with different features, and so seeing one subpopulation living in that area that had some persistent Neanderthal, mixture of older and more modern features makes perfect sense compared to what we've been seeing.
Hey, Bob, I have a quote here. One of the study co-leaders, Darren Curno, from the University of New South Wales, Australia. Hey, Richard, do you know this guy?
Oh, sure. He just lives down the street. No, I don't, but...
Across the desert.
Yeah, he said... this is a quote from him. He said, "We're trying to be very careful at this stage about definitely classifying them." And he continues on later. "One of the reasons for that is that in science of human evolution or paleoanthropology, we presently don't have a generally agreed biological definition for our own species. And he said, believe it or not, and so this is a highly contentious area, he said. So that's a little reassuring that the one of the lead study members there is basically casting doubt on any of the conclusions that they might be finding.
It seems to me they're taking a very reasonable approach to this, just being very cautious about it. But when I see those dates, I'm just amazed to think that there are other species of humans running around as only 11,000 odd years ago. It's insane.
Yeah, it is. It's very weird.
Yeah, that's nothing.
Well, so you think about the mammoth also that was running around the same time. That's hard to grasp as well.
For mammoths, you're going back, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, even more recent.
We missed it by that much.
So, Steve, I wanted to hear what you had to say about a few of the theories that they're throwing around. So they've discussed, Dr. Curnow and his team have two scenarios, and then other scientists that were just following the research have a third scenario, and I'm curious to hear what you guys have to say. So the team has speculated that the findings that they have so far represent a very early migration of a primitive-looking Homo sapien that lived separately from other forms in Asia before dying out. And the second idea they had was that they were indeed a distinct Homo species that evolved in Asia and lived alongside our own kind until remarkably recent. And then other scientists, like I said, were saying that these are just hybrids.
Those are the theories. I mean, if you're just saying what are all the possible ways to fit that data, I think that's it. You know, I don't think that at this point they have any particular reason to think of any one or the other. They could be hybrids. They could just be a subpopulation lingering in this one region. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that as we discover more human fossils throughout Europe and Asia. Remember, there was that other subpopulation found in Siberia, and we remember Homo florentiensis. The hobbit, on the island of Flores. So, evolution is a messy branching bush, and that's what we're just finding more and more twigs all over the place. All right, thanks, Jay. Bob, are we going to have neutrino-based cell phones anytime soon?
Neutrino-based.
Oh, man, I couldn't believe it. Neutrinos are back in the news again.
They're cool. Can
you believe it?
I can't get rid of these damn things.
I wouldn't even be talking about them right now if Steve wasn't making me do it. I'm only kidding. I love neutrinos, and this is actually a pretty cool news item. Researchers have done something new with them that's much more reasonable than supposedly making them travel faster than light. They actually sent and deciphered a message through 780 feet of rock using a beam of neutrinos. Now, this may seem odd if you're familiar with neutrinos, since they're nearly massless and neutral. They therefore ignore the electromagnetic force, and they only very weakly interact with gravity and the weak force. So this means essentially that neutrinos can go through literally light years of lead, like it was a vacuum.
The mean free path is a little over one light year.
Okay.
So on average, still, one light year. But they could theoretically go through many, many light years.
Yeah. Still what? 26 quadrillion miles, is it? I forget how many miles away. But
I think it's quadrillion.
So then how do you actually receive a message if it's made up of neutrinos? And it takes a lot of money. It's a lot of mass, and you also need a lot of neutrinos to do it. But it is doable, apparently. These researchers used a particle accelerator at the Fermi National Accelerator Lab in Batavia, Illinois, Fermi Lab, to make the neutrino. So you need a particle accelerator. Hello. I mean, I don't think we're going to be seeing a particle accelerator in our iPhones anytime soon. And they did this. They used the accelerator to essentially accelerate protons to high speeds and then slam them into carbon atoms, and bam, you got a bunch of neutrinos. And then you need a detector, and to detect the neutrinos, they used a 5-ton particle detector called Minerva, which consists of layers of different materials like carbon and lead and iron. So, but even if you have something really sophisticated like Minerva, it still takes about 10 billion neutrinos before it can even detect just one of them. So its hit rate is very low, but still, I mean, I guess it's not, you could just produce millions and billions of neutrinos, so you can spit out enough of them so that you can send a message that's detectable by something like Minerva. They probably use trillions of neutrinos And they put them into a binary code, which is pretty cool. They did it by sending a bunch of them, and the fact that they are there constitutes a binary one. And when none are sent, when there's nothing being sent, that's your zero. And from there, you can kind of just build up. You can build up any message that you want. And using the scheme, they were able to actually achieve a bit rate of 0.1 bits per second, which kind of reminds me of my bandwidth at my house over here. It took 2 hours to send the whole one word message. Do you guys know what the message was?
Neutrino.
Send yes. more Chuck Berry.
Send more Chuck Berry.
Jay, I was thinking the same thing. Kind of unimaginative, but whatever. So I calculated that at that rate, it would take 272 years to transmit the first 4 Game of Thrones books. And actually, I think that's how long it took Martin to write it. Didn't it take him that long?
Bob, think how long it would take to download like one picture of porn. You know, I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, I wouldn't be interested by the time we got there. So, this is pretty cool. Like, Steve, you mentioned cell phones. Yeah, at least as of right now in the foreseeable future, you need a lot of money, lots of big equipment to even think about producing this kind of stuff. But it is pretty awesome that you can actually send a message using neutrinos. And so what can we do with this kind of thing, though? Is it just something that's just mind game of like, oh, can we do it? But it actually could have some utility at some point in the future. The first thing I thought of was submarine communication.
Yeah.
Because when subs go really deep, it's essentially impossible and very impractical to communicate with them. I think one of the main reasons is the electrical conductivity of the seawater prevents the radio waves from penetrating very deeply. But so if you can somehow communicate using this method, they wouldn't have to surface, they wouldn't have to actually risk themselves to receive or send any information.
Or, Bob, how about a moon base on the far side of the moon?
Yeah, right. You wouldn't need satellites around the moon or any stations on the moon to communicate. Just go right through the moon. That'd be cool. Yeah,
right.
That's another one. I like it.
You say it won't be available on the iPhone. Surely there's not an app for that, isn't there?
Yeah,
it's got to be
an app with an algorithmic accelerator.
This was though. I mean, this was a proof of concept. Just hey, can we theoretically do it? But yeah, this is not going to happen anytime soon because you need a multi-million-dollar accelerator at one end and a massive neutrino detector at the other end.
And not just that, if you wanted to actually communicate to the other side of the planet, I mean, you would need an incredibly dense beam of neutrinos because they do attenuate pretty quickly.
All right, cool, Richard. We've been hearing a lot of news coming out of Australia in terms of alternative medicine. I've been blogging about it. Obviously, this is a topic that I follow very closely. It seems you guys have a big problem with alternative medicine in Australia, but there's a big backlash against it. So why don't you get us up to date on that?
This is very interesting indeed. This is the FSM, and I don't mean the Flying Spaghetti Monster. I mean the Friends, which is unfortunate, but there you go. I mean, the Friends of Science in Medicine, and this is a very new group, only put together late last year, so it is very new indeed. And this was put together by a group of concerned scientists and citizens, really, about the ongoing waste of time and money and resources, as exhibited by some of our top universities, in perpetuating courses in what we can call nonsense. And I don't use that term lightly. When I'm talking about nonsense, I'm talking about hardcore nonsense like iridology, homeopathy, Reiki, reflexology, that sort of thing. So the group was put together. Now, straight away, I just clicked to their website, which is absolutely worth visiting because it's a wealth of information. Friends of Science and Medicine can be found at www.scienceinmedicine.org.au, and you can find out who was behind it, why it's so important this group has come about. Also, supporting this in Australian Skeptics financially, we think it's a wonderful idea, and it's important to note that these people are separate from Australian Skeptics. We always get this people accusing us of being behind these sort of new groups or whatever it is. I mean, we're all going to be accused of being sponsored by Big Pharma anyway. That's unavoidable. Mm-hmm. But they always do that. So we're separate, but we are supporting them. We're absolutely supporting them. One of the major people behind it is Professor John Dwyer, who is a very respected professor here in Sydney at the University of New South Wales. And he, as a matter of fact, for our Sydney listeners, he's going to be speaking at Australian Skeptics Dinner on the 31st of March. Go to www.skeptics.com.au to book your tickets. A little plug for that talk there. But what an important initiative it is. And man, haven't the opposition, the quacks, been quacking loudly about this? There's been press releases. People from our side have been on the radio, Professor John Dwyer and others in the media. And invariably what will happen is that if it's a radio show, then they'll have Professor John Dwyer on the line, and in the studio or on another line, they'll have somebody representing the alternative medicine. And for some reason, the media is focused on homeopaths, which is one of the big things about this Friends of Science and Medicine complaining against homeopathy. And I've heard a couple of interviews on television and radio, and it's so formulaic. We have the representative from our side, and we have the representative from the other side to give what we know is false balance. I mean,
right.
It's as if someone would come along and defend the flat earth. Well, they have got the homeopaths defending their homeopathy. And they seem to be all reading from the same sort of script. And it goes something like this. The John Dwyer, or the person representing our point of view, will have the say why this group was set up. And they'll turn to the other guest, the homeopath, and say, well, homeopath, what do you think about what this person says? And invariably, the script will go something like, well, listen, homeopathy is a natural system of medicine that works with the body in its own healing mechanisms. Yeah. It's been scientifically proven for hundreds of years and is supported by doctors and scientists all over the world. More and more governments are including homeopathy as part of their health system. And studies have shown again and again how effective it is. Now,
so they lie.
Was that about eight? Yeah, it's about eight logical fallacies in that one statement.
But this is what we call, and you probably know the term, gish galloping, right? It's where bombard the opposition with so many statements and things like that. Now, the person representing our side, you cannot address all those points easily and quickly. There's so many points have been put out there. But the real killer will come after they've had a bit of to and throw. If it's on radio, then they'll have a call-in, talkback, right? And who's going to get on the line, incensed, are the fans of homeopathy.
Yeah.
And the caller will say, well, paraphrasing a caller I heard just yesterday on the radio, I couldn't wait to ring up. I'm so angry. Look, 20 years ago when I had my baby and I had mastitis, the doctors couldn't help me. I was taking antibiotics. The only thing that helped me was homeopathy. How can this doctor Dwyer tell me that it doesn't work? Again, this is putting the person from our point of view in a very difficult position, because you cannot then turn around and say, well, look, madam, in this situation, this is exactly what happened to you. It's impossible. So, but it's interesting to see that the media are picking up on this. It really is. It's a fantastic movement as far as I'm concerned. I'm loving every moment of it, because a lot of people now are learning homeopathy, in particular, homeopathy's dirty secret.
Yeah, what it
that
is
that,
that's
that
a
there's
secret.
Nothing in it.
Yeah.
That's the secret. And most people, even defenders, don't know that.
Right.
And it's so important that people realize that what you're buying from the pharmacy, sadly from the pharmacy, has no ingredients. It's a lie. It's a sham. It's a scam. If it was any other product, it would be illegal to do this. Why homeopathy gets a free pass is beyond me, and we are doing everything in this country to end that situation.
Yeah, and the issue surrounds and the thing that really kicked it off in Australia was the issue about teaching this in universities. It's not just, you know, more of the same selling nonsense. It's why is this being supported and taught as if it were legitimate in universities? And it becomes an issue of academic standards and also the responsibility of universities to essentially, if they're teaching a course – they're lending their imprimatur, their seal of legitimacy to that topic.
They're failing to uphold the standards of science for which they should be
absolutely.
Held to.
Yeah.
And for the sake of the rest of society. Now, I think part of the reason is these courses have snuck in. It's been stealth, you know, bit by bit by bit over the years. And these things are becoming more widely accepted in the general community. And so to have a group like this stand up more or less suddenly and say, no, this is wrong, stop it. Well, all the vested interests who are making scads of money, especially the homeopaths who make money out of selling nothing but sugar and water, well, they're defending not only their belief system, but their income. So I can understand why they'd be so strident in their defense. But you know what? Too bad. What they're defending is demonstrably wrong.
It is stealth. You're right. I mean, I've seen that in action myself. I think it's very deliberately so. It's this. It's not just that it's not getting the attention that it deserves. The proponents are trying to slip it in the dead of night without really much public discussion. And I think the best thing about what's happening in Australia is that, you know, at least in the English-speaking world, it really is kicking off another round of, let's talk about exactly what this stuff is. You know, because that's all we're saying. Let's have an open, honest conversation about what it actually is, about what the evidence shows, you know, and just stop the stealth promotion of nonsense. And it really is sad. I mean, it really is a shame that universities are failing in this way. It's happening in the United States as well. Not as bad as what has already happened in Australia, but they're being very successful. In the UK, I have to say, we're already past the peak in that David Cahoon has been very successful in reversing this trend and getting alternative medicine out of UK universities, and he's doing it by exactly what I'm saying, by just simply exposing what's being taught. He's found the single most effective measure is to just send the curricula to the board of trustees, saying, did you know that this is what they're teaching in your university? And that's enough to shame them into shutting down the programs, because it's just showing this is utter pseudoscientific nonsense that your university is teaching. And then there's, you know, your summary of what the proponents say is right on. They just lie.
Yeah, well, it's probably is, and you always have to be careful. I mean, I don't mind calling homeopathy a sham and a scam. It is. There are certainly a lot of people who sincerely believe in it.
They may believe it. It doesn't make it any less a lie in that it's wrong. They haven't been intellectually... they haven't done their intellectual due diligence. You know, if you're going to advocate for something like that, it's your job to make sure that what you're saying is intellectually honest and accurate. And the failure to do that is the failure to do that. And to whatever, you know, at some point there ceases to become a meaningful distinction between deliberate lying and lying because of just intellectual laziness and not caring. Or again, you know, you have so much of a vested interest in selling your nonsense that you'll be taken in by the nonsense. So it doesn't matter. You're still responsible for saying things that are wrong.
And we do reach the stage where we meet people just like the psychics out there and the water diviners who will believe in it, be it homeopathy or Reiki or iridology. And that's the end of the story. There is no getting through to them. So what this group hope to do is basically knock the problem right on the head by stopping it in universities. Now, they're at pains, this group, Friends of Science and Medicine, is at utter pains to make sure that people realize that they are not against testing of alternative claims or looking for new medicines or seeing the validity in this, that, or the other. That's a vital part of scientific research, and that's how we discover more and more. What their thrust is saying, look, it's the 21st century. we can now say these things don't work and consign them to history. It's okay. We can all move on as a society. Or it was worth a shot, you know, when they didn't know better. We know better. It is now wrong to promote them. It is wrong to have them in universities. And that's what this group is doing. And like I said, the Australian Skeptics are so pleased about this that we are supporting them. And I advise listeners all around the world, if they want some ideas, to visit scienceinmedicine.org.au and find out more.
I have to point out that one of the go-to people on the other side, Professor Ian Graham from Southern Cross University, who's essentially defending his university's teaching of this, has had two main points to make. And like a lot of issues that we deal with, creationism, whatever, it's the same fallacious points over and over and over again. One point was, and this is a quote from him, he said that the use of alternative therapies such as homeopathy can be traced back as far back as ancient Greece. Now, homeopathy was invented 200 years ago. Not exactly. Off by an order of magnitude.
Keep trying, pal.
And who cares?
Yeah, it's exactly. It's the yes. argument from antiquity, yeah. But it's always nice when you have a logical fallacy that's also factually incorrect. When I wrote about it, I'm like, I wonder what he thinks about bloodletting and trepanation.
Yeah. It's all good.
Trepanation's cool.
It's a very interesting point you brought up, Stephen, and harks back to what I was saying about when these people get on the radio. Not only will they gish gallop, they will use what we know straight away as logical fallacies, like the argument from antiquity. And 99 times out of 100, the reporter doing the interview doesn't know about the logical fallacy of the argument from antiquity and all the rest of it. So it's a hard battle when you're on. And believe me, I've had experience about being on the media and talking to these people.
We're almost playing a game of name not logical fallacy now. But here's his next statement, which is his other go-to point was 80% of Australians seek alternative therapies. Obviously, orthodox medicine is not working for everyone. There's actually several problems there. So Evan, this is an argument from popularity, which is not valid.
Yes.
You're supposed to teach what is intellectually rigorous and legitimate, despite its popularity. That's the whole point of academic integrity. So using a popularity to defend academic integrity is an oxymoron. Second, the 80% figure...
The argument from stupidity,
that one.
Steve. Don't forget that one.
The 80% figure, I think, has got to be grossly inflated. And we know from many surveys and whatnot that CAM inflates the numbers massively by including all sorts of things into the alternative medicine category. Taking vitamins, dieting, massage, anything they could say.
Yep.
You know, is alternative, and then anything nutritionally based or whatever, boom, that inflates the number. But if you look at like how many people are using homeopathy in the United States, it's still hovering around 3%. Acupuncture, 6 or 7%. It's still tiny numbers, but then they inflate the popularity of homeopathy by including things like vitamins and massage. So it's deceptive, not intellectually honest. Then he makes a false assumption that people are using alternative therapies because orthodox medicine's not working for them. Guess what? That's not true. People use alternative medicines because they're ideologically predisposed to or because they were told it works. They do not cite, they rarely cite, it's very, very much a minority, single digits, that they were unsatisfied with orthodox medicine or their physician or mainstream medicine. That's not why people are using it when they are. It's because it's what people are doing. It's because you know it fits their naturalistic worldview or whatever, or they were told good things about it. That's why people use it.
Or as I hate to see, and I see it every time I go to the pharmacy, it's right there on the shelves.
It's available
right there on the shelves,
and right next to the real medicine too.
Yeah.
You can almost not distinguish the two at times.
When I was in the UK last week, I went to Boots Pharmacy because I've seen it so many times on the internet. And yes, I bought myself for £5.5 or whatever it was, Belladonna 30C. So,
oh, you don't have to worry about werewolves, right?
There it is. There it is. I don't have to worry about werewolves. So I might just keep that on the shelf as a souvenir. So thank you for letting me have my rant all the way from Sydney.
Okay. Well, there is one more news item I wanted to get to. Because this was published this week, and we have to mention it. You guys remember Daryl Bem's Psi research? This is the guy a year ago published a series of 9 studies in a prestigious psychology journal where he claims that the future can influence the past. Essentially, he reversed the sequence of events of standard psychological experiments showing that influences can reach back in time and influence the outcome of performance of subjects before the influence occurs. You know, we were very skeptical of these results for various reasons. There were some methodological issues. The magnitude of the effects are pretty small, and they were not faring very well in early replication. You might also recall that Richard Wiseman had published a replication and was having a hard time getting it published. He had done a replication, but the same journal that published BEM's research refused to publish his replication because they don't publish replications, which you know is this kind of a separate issue. But so now Wiseman and some of his colleagues were able to publish 3 replications of one of the 9 studies. This was the one with the largest magnitude effect, and it was the 9th study. And this one, what the study design was, the subjects would get a list of words, one after the other, and then they would have 5 minutes to recall as many of the words as possible. Then the computer would randomly select half of those words and run the subjects through a couple of practice sessions where they had to group the words, etc. So they would be exposed to half of the words over time, you know, through one of these practice sessions. And BEM claimed in his study, in his results, that people were better at recalling words that they would later practice. Now there have been 3 very precise replications by Stuart Ritchie, Richard Wiseman, and Chris French. Short story is they're all dead negative. Together they have a pretty, you know, a lot of power. They were very careful to they used the same program provided by BEM, the same computer program. They used the same number of subjects. They had to change some of the words to make them into their UK, because these were UK researchers, so they wanted to use the UK versions of certain words. And so really there were trivial changes like that, but otherwise it was really, there were pretty exact replications. And there was also, they mentioned there was a 4th replication that was done by somebody else and published in a different journal that was also negative. This brings up a lot of issues to point out. I was willing to say, just from looking at BEM's studies, well, if you do a research looking for an effect that's impossible, and you find a positive result, you did something wrong. You know, and that's the default explanation, unless and until we see a high-quality study with statistically significant effect with a high signal-to-noise ratio and independent replication. Show me those things and I'll begin to take it seriously. Now we have replications which are dead negative, which is sort of the story with parapsychology, right? Whenever...
Yeah,
you know, people get around to replicating any research paradigm. You know, the effects fade away, but it's the decline effect, right? So now we could say with more confidence, both empirical and theoretical, that BEM's research results were almost certainly wrong. A lot of things about this that we could talk about, but the one thing I want to focus on is that. So how do we explain that, or what does this tell us about how to interpret future research? So the next time a study comes along that looks pretty good on paper, there were quibbles about a lot of the statistical analysis and some of the methods that he used. And BEM was able to argue that, that didn't affect the outcome of the research. Like one thing he did was multiple comparisons without adjusting for that. He also... this is actually a big no-no. He peeked at the data sort of as it was coming in.
What the hell?
So much for double blind.
Well.
And that could have had an influence because there's also some evidence that maybe some optional stopping was involved. Specifically, the fewer the subjects in any given trial in his research, the greater the effect, which sort of suggests that he was sort of stopping when the data looked good. Also, when... like in the study that I described, when subjects misspelled a word, they had to be corrected manually, and the people who were correcting the misspelling errors manually knew which words were the target words and which words were the control words. So that created a huge opportunity to introduce bias into the results. So Bem argues that, well, if you eliminate those words, it still comes out positive. But here's a very important point. There's a lot of choices that researchers make in doing a study. How to do the statistical analysis, you know, which very specific analysis to use. How many subjects to use, like when to stop, you know, collecting data, et cetera, et cetera. And those are what are called researcher degrees of freedom. And we've talked about this before, right? This recent study showing that by just exploiting these researchers' degrees of freedom, you can produce positive results even from a hypothesis that we know is wrong, and therefore the data is zero, right? The results are negative, but you can make them positive just by the wiggle room that researchers have. So even though Bem can defend each tiny criticism, you add them all up together and it gives you a false positive result, which is exactly what he did. The way to know that, or at least strongly implies that, if you do an exact replication where you make all the same choices, so in other words, all the choices have already been made for you, so you're not making them as you go along in order to massage the data, then if the effect's real, the outcome should still be positive. And if it was all false positive because you were exploiting, you know, these choices, then the effect should go away. Well, the effect went away. This strongly implies, in my opinion, that Bem was, whether consciously or subconsciously, was just, you know, exploiting the wiggle room, you know, exploiting the degrees of freedom to generate a false positive results. And that's why they haven't survived replication. But, you know, this is why skeptics are skeptics, right? Because we recognize this. And the next time a study comes around purporting to show that the impossible is true, and sure. You know, we'll look at it and go, you know, yeah, when this happens 10 times, then I'll be interested.
Well, what's Bem's excuse? Why doesn't he get that, right? How can he not see the skeptic angle to it?
I think he's a true believer. I mean, he's actually a respected psychologist, but which, I don't know, it goes to show you can compartmentalize and you could be technically a good researcher, but he's missing the boat on this. You know, remember, we also interviewed another psychologist, Wagenmakers, who is very familiar with Bem and said, you know, if you read his textbook on psychological research, he basically outlines how to generate false positive data as like his recommend, like this is how you... You know, this is the good way to do psychological research. You know, you should look at the data one way, and if it's not positive, well, then just look at it another way and see if you can extract a result from it, you know, just to see if there's anything to your hypothesis.
Steve, that reminds me, if you want good ghost photographs, really, you know, really have a really bright flash so you can see those ghost globules. Like, that's right, actually. That would help.
A little mist in the air, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not a mystery, actually, if you read his own book on how to do psychological research. He basically outlines how to manufacture false positive results. Not a surprise, you know. So yet another parapsychological paradigm goes down in flames. It's tiring being right all the time, isn't it, guys?
Well, come on.
You know, it's a good point, Steve. And it crosses my mind occasionally. I'm thinking to myself, you know, the modern skeptical movement's been going since, what, 1975 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And what huge things if we had to say, well, no, we were completely wrong. But when you think about it, the skepticism isn't about making definite statements. It's about keeping our options open and looking at the best evidence for something.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Now, as I've said before, if your position is the method, following, you know, rigorous methodology, you'll always be right. So, you know, that's what part of what I was saying is tongue-in-cheek. But the other thing I think, which is, I think, a legitimate observation to make about the skeptical movement, is that we do spend a lot of time picking easy targets, you know, because a lot of the proponents of pseudoscience and the paranormal make themselves easy targets. And, you know, we're there showing that, you know, if you actually shine the light of legitimate scientific methodology and logic and critical thinking onto this, you could see that this is you know, pretty blatant pseudoscience. One, it's a good teaching opportunity for the public. And two, it's actually an interesting psychological study of pathological science. How do researchers like BEM do put out research like this? But, you know, because we're picking easy calls from a scientific point of view, it's easy to be right most of the time. We're, it's not like we're picking winners in closely contested legitimate scientific controversies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And we're not the ones making far out statements.
Right.
That's for sure.
Yeah. If homeopathy one day down the track turns out to be correct, then that would be an example of, well,
yeah,
we got it wrong, but I'm not losing any sleep over that.
No, we're going with the high probability mainstream consensus opinions on things. So, you know, taking the whole point is, what's the most likely thing to be true, right? That's the whole point of taking a scientific approach. So it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that that it's going to turn out that way. Evan,
hey Doc,
we had quite a few responses to the Who's That Noisy last week.
One or two, right? So I suppose we should play it and remind everyone of exactly last week's Who's That Noisy. So,
that is familiar. I've heard that before. That's really haunting me, actually.
You ever heard of a tune called The Lincolnshire Poacher?
No.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's the first couple bars.
I see.
Of it. Traditional English folk song. Supposedly composed in the 1700s. It's been around for a while. Associated with the country of Lincolnshire, and the song was dealing with the joys of poaching. And it's all the joys of taking other people's crops and animals and other things that go along with that. It's considered to be the unofficial country anthem of Lincolnshire, and also the Lincolnshire Poacher was the regimental quick march of the 10th Regiment of Foot and its successors, the Royal Lincolnshire Regiment and 2nd Battalion Royal Anglican Regiment. God save the Queen.
God save the
Queen. Now, however, there's a little bit more to it. It is the prelude or the introduction of a transmission that is sent out by a numbers station of the same name and fame.
Yes, yes. Now it's making sense. Yeah,
I would have never guessed how well recognized this particular numbers station would be to our audience. And I'm not quite sure what they mean. Does this mean that so many of our listeners were tuning into shortwave radio signals prior to, you know, the world of podcasting, which came along in 2005? I don't know. It was a torrent. I don't think we've had that many responses to a Who's That Noisy ever. What would you say,
Steve? And everybody got it right, too. That was what was funny about it.
That is true. And we are going to say that everybody wins Who's That Noisy this week, because there was that many people.
Because Brian Dunning, our good friend Brian Dunning from Skeptoid.com, does a public talk. And in one of his talks, he mentions these number stations. Maybe that's where I heard that.
He also did an episode on it on Skeptoid.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but real quick, I'll give you a little bit of the background as far as what a number station is, in case you don't know what we're talking about. They are radio transmitters and radio transmissions, and they transmit shortwave radio signals, which contain, among other things, supposedly secret encoded messages. These coded messages come in the forms of numbers, sets of five numbers at a time. Of course, this is all speculation, in a sense that nobody really admits, as far as, you know, governments go, that these number stations actually exist. So what's the big mystery? Like, why wouldn't you admit to something like this, that these shortwave signals are being transmitted? Well, the most commonly held belief is that these number stations are used by governments for transmitting signals to their spies and spy networks all around the world. And that's one of the beautiful things about using shortwave, is that under ideal conditions, a shortwave radio signal can travel around the world. Mm-hmm. You can pick it up with
Is it neutrino-based?
Receivers. Not yet, but they're working
so
on it.
So do you know how it that
they're
happens?
They're working on it.
How can you make a radio signal go around the Earth?
Bounce it off the ionosphere.
Yeah, that's right. It bounces back off the ionosphere. So it bounces around
the
Earth.
Aren't you guys smart?
Oh, the ionosphere.
Okay.
Well.
So, a little more on this. These radio transmissions, right, they're one-way transmissions. You really can't answer back. But the beauty about number station transmissions is that the encryption system used to decode the messages, which is known as a one-time pad, is an unbreakable system. So in the system, how it works is both the sender and the recipient each have copies of a code pad. The code pad has several columns of numbers, which seem to be at random. The received numbers are added or subtracted from the numbers on the sheet of the one-time pad being used, and the results are compared to a master code key list. Each number block usually represents a complete word or phrase rather than a sequence of characters, and after each page is basically gone through or used up, that's it. That's the end of the code. And if used correctly, it is said that this system is unbreakable. Even modern computers, algorithms, 21st century technology cannot compare with the effectiveness of this code system, which apparently has been used reportedly since just after World War I. So we're approaching about 100 years worth of having used this system.
Yeah, I think it's one of those semi-conspiracy theories that actually is plausible. I mean, it would be a good way for governments to communicate with spies in the field. You know, it's like if this is a sort of a government secret, it's pretty poorly kept. You know, it's like one of those secrets that everybody knows. So mm-hmm. would they continue to do that despite widespread belief that and knowledge of these specific number stations? But I guess if it, the counter argument is, as you say, it doesn't really matter if it's an unbreakable code and you need the sheet of paper, you need the physical object, tapping into the number station doesn't help
you. Does you no good?
Does you no
That's
good,
right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I could kind of make sense of it either way. The other thing I have trouble with is if these are not governments communicating to their spies in the field, what are they?
Yeah.
Well, some people believe that it's used to transmit signals to, say, drug dealers, right, for, other illegal activity going on. Was that really being used, so many years ago? Maybe that's a more just modern conception or a modern idea. Now, someone else online suggests that another alternative is that these stations are nothing more than the transmission of grid coordinates by radar surveillance stations tracking aircraft. That's pretty mundane, I suppose. But why would
wouldn't that just be public knowledge?
Yeah, why all the coded messages in that sense? I mean, does it really have to go through all these through this sort of machination to get the information across? I don't know.
All right, Ev, well, what do you got for this week?
This week, we've got something pulled out of the vault. I've had this one on ice for quite a while. Here we go.
The fuel supply would be plentiful, and it could, in this embodiment, be carried out, we think, in a very simple manner.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Thanks, Evan. We're going to do one email question this week. This is an audio question. Now, we have asked in the past for listeners who are interested and they want us to answer a question on the show, to actually record them saying the question. But we don't get too many of them, and unfortunately, we always have to get a good combination of good audio quality, which is pretty uncommon, and a question that we actually want to discuss. But we finally got one, at least the first in a while. This comes from Alex Boucher from Australia. So I had to use it this week, Richard, the countryman of yours. So let's hear his question.
Hi there, skeptics. I'm Alex from Australia. Let me preface this question by saying that my mother, although having no background in science, made the decision not to get me vaccinated as a child. I've recently made inquiries with my local general practitioner as to how I should best go about catching up on the vaccination schedule. My question to you is a scientific one. Now, by not having these vaccinations as a child, will I now be less able to receive the same level of immunity as I would have if I had been vaccinated at the appropriate age? I love the show and look forward to your answer.
Well, thank you, Alex. That's a great question. The short answer is no, they will not be less effective. Vaccines essentially work by exposing your immune system to antigens, to proteins, or sometimes parts of viruses or bacteria or whatever, that then trigger an immune response. Your immune system responds to those proteins as if they are an infection, and it mounts an immune response. One of the wonderful things about our immune system is they have a memory. They remember whatever they've been exposed to, whatever they've mounted a response to in the past. They actually generate memory cells, which can then produce antibodies much more quickly in the future. It's interesting because the immune system has a very evolutionary model to it. Do you guys know this?
Yeah.
Essentially, our immune system uses the gunshot approach, right? It makes antibodies to everything, but those antibodies don't have a lot of specificity towards anything specifically. It's just blanketing the possible antigens out there in the world. And then when it responds to an infection or any kind of invading organism, part of that response is to fine-tune the antibodies to that specific protein or organism. So not only does it remember how to make antibodies against an infection, those antibodies have a much greater ability to bind to the invading organisms. It's much more specific to them. That's how vaccines work. They train your immune system to respond to a very specific antigen, a virus or bacteria. That happens no matter what age you are, as long as your immune system is healthy. If you're physically run down, you won't mount as good as a response. You know, the geriatric population, the really old population, they have less of a robust immune response. And if you're already fighting off another illness, your immune system is using up its resources to fight off another infection, then you won't mount as much of a response to a challenge. But, you know, a healthy adult will mount a full immune response and have a full effect from a vaccine that a child does. The timing of the vaccines is mainly about giving them early enough to prevent the diseases that they're geared against. You know, so if it's, you know, we give them as early as it's safe to give them in order to cover the period of vulnerability when a child is likely to be exposed or is vulnerable to those infections. So it's more about getting the protection as early as possible, but not about the ability to mount an immune response.
But that's a terrific question from Alex. A really, really thoughtful question, and it probably crossed the mind of a lot of people. And as an adult myself, I've had pertussis boosters a number of years back. I didn't keel over and die, strangely enough, and I'm doing okay. But yeah, a wonderful question, and maybe it'll give some adults out there some thought to pause and run off to the doctor and make sure that if they haven't been vaccinated, well, now's the time.
All right, well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Richard, Bob has 100% record so far this year.
What?
Yeah, he's been wrong every week.
There's a lot of pressure. We'll see how long he can maintain it. All right, here we go. Item number one. A recent survey finds that cashews are the most common nut allergy, affecting almost 2% of school-age children. Item number two. A new analysis suggests that early feathered dinosaurs may have developed their feathers for display. And item number three, a new report exposes a vast illegal market in transplant organs from live donors, including kidneys, parts of livers, and corneas. Richard, as our guest, you get to go first.
So, number one, a recent survey finds that cashews are the most common nut allergy, affecting almost 2% of school-aged children. Oh, I find this a bit strange, because all I hear about in this country are peanuts. Everyone goes mad about peanuts. Does your food have any peanuts? Children aren't allowed to use peanut butter sandwiches. Can't take them to school.
Poor kids.
Poor kids. I love peanut butter. I'm going to think about that one. Let's see. We have our old friends, the feathered dinosaurs may have developed their feathers for display. I'd totally buy that. Why not? Evolution works in strange ways. As we know, evolution doesn't have an end game in mind. Things sort of progress and change with the flight was not in any thought, any out there in the Oort cloud or the ether when feathers came along. And a new report exposes a vast legal market in transport organs from live donors, including kidneys, parts of livers, and corneas. That'd be pretty dire if that was happening, wasn't it? I'm going to peg number two about the feathered dinosaurs as being science. Am I allowed one or two science?
Two science, one fiction.
Bam! Then I'm going to have to go for, although I haven't heard about it, I think I've got serious doubts about the nut one. I'm going to go through number three about the organs as science as well. So two and three, we're leaving one as the fiction.
The nut one is the fiction is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Jay?
All right. It's the one about the cashews are the most common nut allergy. First off, I was thinking that nut allergies in general would be less than 2%. I was just talking to people, and Bob, I think you and I were talking about nut allergies not too long ago, and we were saying, was a cashew, the actual casing of a cashew is really dangerous. The nut itself is not, but the actual shell, people can have an allergy to. And I know you're not talking about that, Steve, but that's interesting. Moving down the list, the one about the analysis suggesting that early feathered dinosaurs may have developed their feathers for display. Well, okay. This is a good and interesting thing to talk about. Feathers are definitely used for show, and used for, insulation, and used for flight in some animals. And there's, lots of different really good things that feathers do, but I really do get the whole idea that feathers first came about for show. I could really see someone making a very strong argument for that. And the last one about the report exposing the vast illegal market in transplant organs. Now, come on. We covered this a million times. I mean, unless this has recently changed, there is no vast and illegal market about people, donating. What is this? Transplanting live organs, kidneys and all that? No, I don't. That one is on the list, absolutely. So I'm going to put that on the maybe list right now. All right, I'm going to do a Costanza this week. My gut is telling me to go with the one about the organ donor situation. So I am going to actually go with the first one, which is the nut allergy as the fake.
Okay. Evan?
Oh, the nut allergy. So, cashews. Now, how many school-age children are eating cashews? It's not the most popular nut. Certainly peanut is the first one that comes to mind. But cashews, I don't know. The feathered dinosaurs ones, I think I have the most confidence of the three that this one's science. And the last one, the vast illegal market in transplant organs from live donors, including kidneys, livers, parts of livers and corneas. Parts of livers. It's interesting.
Well, if you donate your whole liver, you're no longer a living donor.
I get that. Yes. No. But I didn't even know you could donate part of your liver. I didn't even know that. I'm tempted to say that this one's the fiction. It's definitely between the nuts and the organs. Which one? Which food always? Which food group am I going to go with? Well, I'm leaning towards the organs, one being fiction. But hang on. I'm not ready to take my finger off the chess piece yet, Steve. Hang on.
Your nuts are hanging?
Hang on.
Commit.
I'll stick with it. I'll live or die by it. And ha!
Liver.
Get it. And stick with the organs being the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
The fact that in order for this to work, I mean, this isn't like somebody making bootleg booze in their basement or growing marijuana in their backyard. I mean, you're taking kidneys and livers and corneas out. Very specialized work. You're not going to really be doing it yourself. You're going to have to include a lot of people. It would take a lot of specialized talent and equipment to actually pull this off. To me, that makes it less likely. And the one word that's getting me here is vast. But I could see other countries where $50 can basically feed your family for a month type of thing where, yeah, you might want to, let go of a kidney. So that kind of weakens my argument a little bit. But that's what I can't seem to get away from that it would be so hard to have so many people. The dinosaur one, the feathered dinosaurs, yeah, that's just almost too easy, I think. And the cashews, yeah, I don't know what to make of that. 2%, I don't know. Does that seem a little bit high? And cashews, I never would have thought cashews. But still, this vast illegal market in transplant organs, I can't seem to get away from that one. So I'm going to say that one's fiction. Ah, I'm scared.
Okay. So we got an even split. Jay and Richard think that the nuts is the fiction. Bob and Evan think that the illegal transplant market is the fiction. You all agree, amazingly, that a new analysis suggests that early feathered dinosaurs may have developed their feathers for display.
I'm worried now.
Uh-oh.
You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science. Ooh.
Yeah. Don't do that.
So yeah, you guys, hit upon that was kind of the easy one, but it's a very cool news item. You guys familiar with Microraptor?
Yeah.
Oh sure.
Microraptor had
a little guy,
wings. Yeah. Four wings. Very
four.
Pretty. Four wings. Yeah, arms
awesome.
And legs. Arms and legs.
Mm.
And
like two of them have one purpose and two of them have another purpose?
And, well, a new analysis of its remember, researchers have been figuring out ways to see what the color of feathers were based upon the proteins. So they had iridescent wings, similar to like a modern crow or grackle. Grackles are actually more iridescent than crows. And also they had these elongated tail feathers. So a new reconstruction makes it look much more like these were elaborate display organs, and they're not really optimized for flight. Not that they couldn't fly, but that these feathers were, like the long tail feathers, et cetera, were for display. And they hypothesized that it's possible that one of the pre-adaptations, the things that feathers were for before they were for flight, because Richard is right, feathers must have developed before flight, because they had to develop for a while before they would have been really useful as flight feathers. So one hypothesis is that feathers were for warmth, just for thermoregulation. Display is another one, and this sort of supports, at least in some lineages, that display was an early adaptation for feathers. Another one is that they were maybe useful for catching insects, for trapping small prey. I don't know how popular that one is. And then the other one is gliding, which could either have been maybe just prolonging the distance of a predatory pounce. If you jump on prey, you can sort of glide a couple extra feet and jump on it from a greater distance, and then perhaps later descending, gliding down from branches, and then eventually, to full feathered flight. Once you get any aerodynamic pressure in there, selective pressure, then you're on, theoretically you're on a short path to flight. So let's go to number one. A recent survey finds that cashews are the most common nut allergy, affecting almost 2% of school-aged children. I'm going to torture you a little bit longer with this one before I give you the answer.
You bastard.
What if I told you...
I can't take it.
...that peanuts are not nuts. They're legumes.
Oh, that's right.
They're legumes.
Oh,
yeah.
Damn
they're
it.
Legumes.
That's right.
What if if I further told you that cashews contain the same allergic-creating protein that poison ivy does?
Oh my!
What?
Do you guys know that?
I just ate a bunch of cashews.
What
today,
the hell,
they
Steve?
Were good.
I just ate a bunch of poison ivy.
URUSHIOL. It's a resin that can create significant allergic skin rashes. But still, that one is the fiction.
Oh!
Wow!
It was a good run.
Well, hold on. Did I win and Bob lose?
Yes, amazing as that sounds.
And Jay, it happens once every few months.
And did I do a clean sweep? Excuse me. Did I do a clean sweep?
Yeah, but you had to use the Costanza gambit.
Whatever, Bob. Whatever.
Caribbean
sorry.
Used a very large array.
I'm sorry, Bob. I'm sorry that I was the vessel to break your 100%.
Yeah, that's all right.
I'm sorry.
Well, Jay, you're taking credit for this now. I finally tricked Bob, and you're trying to take credit? All right. I actually toyed with the idea of using the peanuts are not nuts gambit to make something to trick you guys, but I figured that would be too cruel.
Yeah, it would have been.
So there's the total percentage of nut allergies, including peanuts and tree nuts, is about 1.3 to 1.4%. Peanuts comprise 1%, so that's mostly peanut allergies. Although there are a lot, there's a lot of crossover. There's a lot of the same proteins between peanuts and tree nuts, and therefore people who have allergies to one often have crossover allergies to the others. So it's not like a clean category. And it is true that cashews do contain the same allergic resin that's in poison ivy, but they're heat-treated to take it out of cashews. So even if you buy raw cashews in the store, they're not truly raw. They have been steamed or boiled or heat-treated in some way to remove that resin so that they are safe to eat. The news item that inspired me to concoct that was interesting in and of itself. What they did was, it was a survey of adults and children looking at their ability to identify different nuts on sight. What they wanted to know is do children or parents of children who have nut allergies, are they better able to identify the different nuts on sight than children or parents who do not have allergies? Okay, what do you think the answer was?
Nope.
I don't care.
They were not better. Bob's still in mourning. Is it mourning the passing of his perfect record?
Bob's ready to say goodnight.
So adults got about 58% correct of the 19 nuts that they were asked to identify. Children did worse than that. They got about 30-something percent. And older adults did better. So the older you were, basically, the better you did. Healthcare professionals did no better than the general population.
Mm-hmm.
Parents with kids with allergies did no better than parents of kids without. So this was in a pediatric, journal, and it was the point was we need to do a better job of educating people with allergies to identify the nuts they're allergic to. And also, and I've read there and in other sources when I was doing some background research for this piece, that the pediatricians basically, if you have a peanut allergy, they just say, just don't eat any nuts, because they don't want to trust the patient not to to be able to identify one nut from another. So it's easier just to say avoid all nuts. And because of that issue I brought up about crossover allergies, and these can really be very rapidly fatal, anaphylactic allergic reaction. So it is a serious health problem if you have a peanut allergy.
That's what we say in the Australian Skeptics, avoid all nuts.
Avoid all nuts, that's right.
At all costs.
Thank you and good night.
All of this means that a new report exposes a vast illegal market in transplant organs from live donors, including kidneys, parts of livers, and corneas, is science. And Bob, I agree with you. This was a tough one. I might have gotten taken on this one too, because you wonder how could you carry out a vast black market. But a researcher did undercover, investigation and was able to expose this network. Of course, it's in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
I didn't say it was in any particular country. But it does cross over into neighboring countries like India, etc. And this is how essentially it works. The brokers, the people who are making all the money, hook up rich individuals who need an organ with a poor prospective donor. They promise to pay the poor donor a lot of money. Oftentimes, these donors don't even know what they're getting into. One case that they reported on, the guy didn't even know what his liver was. They're offered an amount of money that to them seems like a massive. Like you were right there, Bob. They're living on $2 a day, and they're being offered the amount of $1,000 to $2,000. That's huge. They think they're going to become, by their standards, rich. And so they're willing to go through with this. So their documents are forged saying that they are related and that the organ is being donated, as a free of will. And then the hospitals, the doctors, the insurance companies kind of all know what's going on is shady, but they look the other way because, they make money off of the whole process as well. So everybody kind of looks the other way, and then so it's illegal. It's illegal to buy organs, so it's an illegal network. But it's the fraud isn't just pretending that they're family members. And then a lot of times the poor donors are shafted. They're paid very little compared to what they were promised. They're really hurt by the surgery. You know, some of them are like not able to work afterwards. They're in chronic pain. Even corneas, that's the thing. People are willing to sacrifice an eye in order to feed their family. So they're being exploited. It's a human rights violation. It's illegal. And it's just sort of happening, and people are just letting it happen and looking the other way because it's necessary. Not necessary, but because it's keeping the whole operation going. So good job, Richard. You went first. You pulled it out. You sniffed out that cashew allergy like no problem.
Well, it was a toss-up. So it wasn't quite the Costanza method I used, but yeah, somehow I snuck in.
Jay, do you have a quote this week?
I have a quote. This quote was sent in by a listener named Mark Schindler from Honolulu, Hawaii. And this quote is, "Science is a way to teach how something gets to be known, what is not known, to what extent things are known, for nothing is known absolutely, how to handle doubt and uncertainty, what the rules of evidence are, how to think about things so that judgments can be made, how to distinguish truth from fraud and from show." Any guesses?
Sarah Palin. I think not.
One of my all-time favorites, Richard Feynman.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
Can never go wrong with Feynman.
He was a fine man. Jay, you have a couple of announcements this week.
I have two very important announcements this week. So on March 29th, two listeners of the show are getting married, and the cool thing about this wedding is that it's a non-traditional wedding with a skeptical twist.
Wow, a skeptically themed wedding?
Yeah, well, you know, my wedding had a skeptical theme, and I think Wayne may have heard me talk about it on the show, and he came up with a really cool idea. So the first thing is, Wayne, his full name is Wayne Freeman, is surprising his soon-to-be bride, Tisha Harrington, with the entire wedding, which I've never heard of that before. And Wayne, I really hope that you pulled it off and that you know what you're doing. Wayne planned this secular service, and it's being performed by a friend of his who's an English lord. And there's going to be skeptically themed readings, including something Wayne wrote called The Galaxy Song, which is cool. And he's naming the tables after scientific and skeptical heroes, and each of the tables are going to have quotes on the tables from this person. So the guests can sit there, and they'll know who the table is named after, and they'll read quotes from them and get to talk about that. You know, add to the mood of the entire event, which is really cool. I mean, for somebody like me, that would be awesome. You know, that's like the perfect wedding. The reason I wanted to mention this, not only because Wayne came up with something very romantic and cool, especially for geeks like us, but I think it's a really good example for our listeners about how critical thinkers can have a romantic and intellectually honest celebration that's about their lives together. And Wayne also asked me to find him a quote that had critical thinking and skepticism and romance woven together. And, you know, Wayne, I looked and I couldn't find anything, so I wrote you something. I thought that this would be better because I'm writing it specifically for what you requested as opposed to me trying to fit something in. So my quote is, "Love does not come from our heart but from our mind, which is a far more wonderful and profound origin. Because only in your mind can love, passion, and the pursuit of truth and honesty all intertwine and act as one." Good luck, guys.
That was very nice, Jay.
Thank you, Steve.
And congratulations, you guys. Good luck with everything. Well, Richard, it's wonderful having you on the show. Anything coming up soon that you should tell people about?
Well, just generally speaking, for those listeners in Australia, to find out more about what's happening in Australia, skeptics.com.au should be your first port of call. And if you want to listen to an Australian-sounding podcast from a skeptical angle, The Skeptic Zone, skepticzone.tv. And if you want skepticism into your school, into your high school, check out mysteryinvestigators.com. Thank you.
All awesome outlets of critical thinking and skepticism. Well, thanks again for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums.
For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.